We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you via the ETIM Network, the online, live, interactive division of Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Let's start. Tonight is sort of a little adventure. Taking a piece of Talmud, seeing it in its original context, and then looking at it through the lens of Emmanuel Levinas. I just realized it's a little unnerving to see myself. Great. That's what we're going to do tonight, specifically. Emmanuel Levinas, for those of you who don't know, is one of the great thinkers of 20th century Jewish thought. He was born in 1906 in and did all of his early education there in traditional yeshivot, but went to France, to Strasbourg, for university, and really stayed there for pretty much the rest of his life, as far as I know. He only passed away in the 90s. So he really spans the 20th century, and thought is foundational alongside Buber and Rosenzweig and all these big names you hear in philosophy. And our class tonight is comes from this book. I hope you guys can see it. Nine Talmudic readings. Basically, Levinas. This better? Let me know if you can't hear me. So Levinas takes a selection of Talmud and uses it as a jumping off point to speak about much larger. It's on and off. Someone, you're telling me that my voice is in and out. Or David or Boris, whoever is tech support, can you tell me if there's anything I can do about this? It's okay now. Okay, so maybe I should just sort of stay a little more stationary. Keep going. Okay, we're going to keep going. So Levinas takes this chunk of Talmud and, like I said, uses it as a springboard to get into larger philosophical issues and uses his, modern philosophical language, even though he's talking about a very ancient text. So we'll start with the Gemara, really start with the Mishnah. And the only caveat I'll give, I actually want to read something to you something that I did not Xerox, but is in this Talmudic reading. Levinas is speaking at some sort of conference in front of a bunch of French intellectuals, as he calls them. And he says, I wish to make a comment. The lines you are reading are about forgiveness. He's referring to the lines in the this is only one of countless texts in the Talmud that the Talmud devotes to this subject. Therefore, one should not think after hearing me that the Jewish intellectuals of France now know what Jewish tradition thinks of forgiveness. In other words, don't think you know what Gemara has to say. Don't think you know what Judaism has to say about forgiveness just from this little piece. And what I'm going to say is, my goals are very modest. Don't think we know Levinas as Levinas just from this little selection. I'm going to try my best to really keep focus on this selection of Levinas and on this piece of Gemara, really as an exercise in how Levinas treats the Talmud. So that's my caveat, and I think now we can jump right into the Mishnah. So for those of you who are able to follow along in the Mishnah, we're looking, in my handout that I had sent, I bracketed off the section of the Mishnah that Levinas focuses on. So we're not even going to look at the whole Mishnah. We're only looking at those couple of lines, which starts with Averot Shebein Adam L'Makom. And this is probably a very well-known concept to many of you, that Averot Shebein Adam L'Makom Yom HaKippurim Mechaper, the things between man and God. For that, Yom Kippur atones. But Averot Tevin Adam L'Chaveiro Eino Makipur Mechaper. Yom Kippur does not atone for sins between man and fellow man, between human beings, Ad Sheyeraseh Et Chaveiro, until this individual appeases his or her friend. End of concept. The next couple of lines is basically just a quote of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah deriving this concept, sort of out of a drush of a pasuk. It says Mikol Chatzotechem Lifnei Hashem Titaru. So it's Lifnei Hashem that Averot Tevin Adam LaMakom Yom Kippur Lechaper. He basically derived it from that pasuk, but it's the same exact concept. So that's what we're dealing with. The fact that something about Yom Kippur is sufficient to atone for whatever flaws we have in our relation to God, but it doesn't take care of the sins between man and fellow man until we've taken care of it between ourselves. And what we're going to see is Levinas focuses on this distinction. He doesn't really focus on the message quite as much as the distinction between these two categories. He uses this Mishnah as an opportunity to find what are sins against God and what are sins against man and what is the nature of each of those types of sins and which one is worse. That, to me, is the interesting question. Which one is worse? And he actually gets there. So if you look at your handout, but look at the first page in the Levinas that I xeroxed for you. This is page 16 and 17. And look at, yeah, I actually placed an arrow at the paragraph that starts with how. And Levinas gets into it. How are the transgressions against God and the transgressions against man distinguished? He says, on the face of it, nothing is simpler than this distinction, right? Anything that can harm my neighbor, either materially or morally, as well as any verbal offense committed against him, constitutes a transgression against man. It's pretty simple. But listen to how he defines transgressions against God. Transgressions of prohibitions and ritual commandments, he starts to list them. Okay, so lo taseh, ritual commandments, idolatry, despair. He throws despair in there as an offense against God. Belong to the realm of wrongs done to the eternal. And then he goes on with more mitzvot that we recognize and expect in this category. Not to honor the Sabbath, the laws concerning food, right? Kashrut, not to believe in the triumph of the good. He tosses that in there. An offense against God. Not to believe in the ultimate good. Or that goodwill will triumph. Not to place anything above money or even art. It's a very French sort of comment there, right? Well, art we know is above money, but there might even be something above art. So that is considered an offense against God. He's not just talking about the stuff we do, the Shabbat, the Kashrut, the rituals. You know, I didn't shake my lulav this year. Well, that's an offense against God. He's talking about much more fundamental traits about ourselves, beliefs that we hold. Basically, anything that doesn't directly hurt another person sort of by default falls into the category of sins against God. And then he launches into, well, which is worse? Like I said, which is more severe? Probably the better way to say it. It's more severe. And he starts out actually earlier on the page, which we didn't read about. He starts out by saying, it seems that sins against man are tougher to get rid of. Why? Well, we read in the Mishnah, right? Not only do you need this personal kapara, but you need to go and ask forgiveness and be at the mercy of this other person's goodwill. And he actually does say it a little bit in the next paragraph, right, a couple lines down. The fact that forgiveness for ritual offenses depends only on penitence, and consequently only on us, may project a new light on the meaning of ritual practices. So he says not to depend on the other to be forgiven is certainly, in one sense, to be sure of the outcome of one's case. In other words, it's a little bit more certain, it's a little bit more sure, because I only have to depend on myself, my own changing. I don't have to be, like I said, at the mercy of this other person. But then when he goes on, and you can skip to the top of the next page, page 17, where I put that other arrow, perhaps the ills that must heal inside the soul without the help of others are precisely the most profound ills. And that even where our social faults are concerned, once our neighbor has been appeased, the most difficult part remains to be done. What's he saying? He's saying, yeah, it's tough. We've got to get forgiveness from the other person. But that part is even the easy part, because if he or she grants you forgiveness, you've still got internal work to do. And he continues, doing wrong toward God, have we not undermined the moral conscience as moral conscience? There's something in the self. There's something fundamental. He calls it the ills of the soul. And as he goes on, right, the ritual transgression that I want to erase without resorting to the help of others would be precisely the one that demands all my personality. It is the work of teshuvah, of return, for which no one can take my place. So that is the tough work. And you'll notice this is typical of Levinas. He understands morality as part of that umbrella of offenses against God. Yes, there's a person involved, but there's also something higher, a higher idea, capital I, or as he says here, moral conscience as moral conscience. And again, I don't want to be too ambitious in trying to define Levinas. I'm not a Levinas scholar, but I do believe that Levinas and all of these highfalutin philosophers have a lot to tell us about our personal Judaism. And here, you know, this is what Shiva is. This is what it's all about on Yom Kippur. And that's the tough part. That's the tough part. And at toward the bottom of this page, he then brings it back to the communal. From, you know, he was in the realm of the individual. He comes back and says, this work is so hard. This work that we each have to do alone, on our own, is so hard that we need the communal order that comes with Yom Kippur. We need Yom Kippur, the structure of the day, to facilitate us in accomplishing that work. So to him, that's tshuva, that's Yom Kippur. That is what he thinks of as being with God. He says in the second paragraph, right, to be before God would be equivalent then to this total mobilization of oneself. I think it's incredible. Any comments so far? Actually, I'm going to stop at this point just to, if there are any questions, just clarification-wise. Anything that isn't clear, there's for sure a lot that isn't clear, but are we all on the same page? Basically, what Levinas has done is he's drawn this distinction. He has clearly drawn one higher than the other, one category more intensive in its reach and in its work. And he got all of that from the Mishnah, implicitly from the Mishnah. Or at least he uses the Mishnah as a structure. Okay, so that's basically what Levinas does with the Mishnah. And now what we'll do is we'll go on to the Gemara, we'll read a little bit of it inside, and then we'll jump back to the Levinas and see what he does with it. So pull out your Gemara once again. And we'll have to go to the next page, where the Gemara appears. And you'll see the first words of our Mishnah. There's a bracket there. Averot shebein adam lamakom. And, sorry, one. So averot shebein adam lamakom. This first section, don't worry too much if you don't get every piece of the Gemara. Just get the main idea, because Levinas is going to, again, think more broadly. So, Rami le Rav Yosef bar Chebo le Rabbi Abahu. So Rabbi Yosef bar Chebo has an argument. He first quotes those lines in our Mishnah, Averot Shebein Adam L'Chavero, Ein Yom HaKippurim L'Chaper, that one line that says, you know, Yom Kippur is not going to atone for those sins between man and fellow man, but he throws out a pasuk. He says we have a pasuk that contradicts that. The Hakati doesn't say, and this is a quote from Shmuel Aleph, doesn't it say, Ine chata ish le'ish ufilelo Elohim? If a person sins against another person, then Elohim will judge that. Meaning, it sounds like, well, God's going to jump in the middle between issues between man and fellow man. So doesn't that contradict this line in the Mishnah that says that, well, the only thing that can help you is going to this person and asking for forgiveness? So the answer returned here, I guess by Rabbi Abahu, is, man Elohim. What does this word Elohim mean in this case? It doesn't mean God. Elohim, the word also means judgment or judge. It says, Dayana. Man Elohim, Dayana. It means a judge, meaning we need to have a human being in there, someone who's going to judge between these two people. That is how he tries to solve the contradiction. But Rabbi Yosef comes back and says, well, no, that then doesn't make sense in the context of the rest of the pasuk. Ihachi, Ema Seifav, if this is so, well, the end of the pasuk doesn't make sense, because the end says, V'im l'Hashem yachata, ish, mit palelo. The end of the pasuk says, if man sins against God, who can intercede on his behalf? Who can daven for him, or in this case, if we're using the term judgment, who can judge between them? And the implication is, doesn't God have plenty of means to judge, plenty of ways to deal with sins against God? It's a weird argument, but in any case, I think that's the gist of it. The point is, Rabbi Yosef says, no, we can't solve it by saying Elohim means judge. Elohim here clearly means God. So rather, he says, Hachi Ka'amar, we need to restate the pasuk and reread it in sort of a stretched kind of way, which the Gemara loves to do. Hachi Ka'amar, im yechata ish le'ish ufilu lo, Elohim yimcholo. In those words, yimcholo, which now makes sense to say, if a person sins against another person and he judges him, or they reconcile to each other, whatever that might mean, then God will forgive him. V'im l'Hashem yechata ish. And if a person sins against God, mi talel ba'ado, who will intercede on his behalf? The answer comes, tshuva l'asim tovim. So we've added a bunch of words to the pasuk, we've fiddled around with the syntax and with the sense of it, but we've gotten to some settlement where it at least doesn't contradict the sense of the Mishnah. Levinas is not going to care about most of this back and forth. He just reiterates it. I didn't even xerox that part for you, where he reiterates the line of argument, but where he gets to the meat of it is the concept that's being put out there as a possibility, that im yechata ish l'ish ufil lo Elohim, that Rabbi Yosef suggests that a person will sin against another person, and God will somehow intercede and brush it away. God will solve the problem, rather than the two people solving it themselves. And that is where we're going to jump back into Levinas. So, jump back to page 19. Levinas zooms in. What he's going to do, what he did in the last section is sort of define his terms. And now in the Gemara, he really gets into the sins between man and fellow man. And what he's going to do here is emphasize, actually ironic, because in the previous section, he emphasized the fundamental nature of these sins against God. Here he's going to emphasize the utmost importance of sins against man, that these cannot just be brushed under the rug by God, or as he sees God in his modern terms, by some universal order. So hold on to your hat, and you see where I underlined on the superior plane. So this is how he defines Rabbi Yosef's suggestion, that on the superior plane, the plane of Elohim, within the absolute on the level of universal history. So he's using all these terms, universal history, absolute, all of these refer to his concept of God or the divine. On that level, everything will work itself out. In 100 years, no one will think about our sorrows, our little worries, and offenses. That's what he says is Rabbi Yosef's suggestion, his suggested way of reading that preface. And the next line, where I have the arrow, Rabbi Yosef Rachabez, thus opposes the thesis of the Mishnah with a thesis that will seduce many a modern person. And if you go down actually to where I bracketed, tears and laughter of mortals, he says, according to this thesis, do not count for much. What matters is the order of things in the absolute. You must see Rabbi Yosef Rachabez's exegesis to the end, right? Logical conclusion. The irreparable offense is that done against God. What is serious is the attack of a principle. So essentially he's saying, as he says here, Rabbi Yosef is ignoring the individual. He believes in the universal. And an individual against an individual has no importance at all. Rather, when a principle is undermined, there you have catastrophe. He is understanding Rabbi Yosef's suggestion as a suggestion of a worldview. And if you turn to the next page, right, as he says at the bottom of the page here, if man offends God, who could set this disorder straight, right? But if you turn to the next page, he says the first paragraph there, the text of the Gemara rises against this virile, overly virile proposition. In other words, the Gemara rejects this reading of the Pasuk, not because it's a bad reading, but because the philosophy behind it is utterly disturbing, at least in Lebanon. So see where that arrow is, and I bracketed. Lebanon says, God is perhaps nothing but this permanent refusal of a history which would come to terms with our private tears. God is perhaps nothing but this permanent refusal of a history which would... Saying all that stuff we say to each other, has cosmic implications. History as history itself, or as godliness, will not brush that under the rug, will not come to terms with our private tears, will not let that slide, or, if you will not just allow Yom Kippur to brush it over. Rather, those private tears, something that needs to be dealt with. Huge. And he says it in this huge language, right? God is nothing but this. And I think for Levinas, God and morality, as we said before, are somewhat one and the same, ultimate morality, moral conscience, as we saw before. So they are obviously intertwined and not two separate categories, as he spoke about them before. But they're fundamental. And they're fundamentally a part of each other. And the way God is expressed, I think this is what he means, the way God is expressed is through our minutia of our lives, and specifically the way we treat each other. So this sort of ends the portion of Levinas' lasting philosophical, if you may. He's laid out what he believes is the nature of God and morality, of transgressions against humans, transgressions against God. He has emphasized the utmost importance of all of those little details, all those things we say to each other and do to each other. And what I want to do next is zip quickly through the Gemara for the next couple of lines and get to a point where there starts to be anecdotes. Stories, agadata, and Levinas uses those anecdotes as sort of like a case study. Okay, here are these ideas that I just laid out. Let's see what happens when you apply them to real life. Let's see what happens when someone actually tries to ask another person for forgiveness. And things start to unravel a little bit, get to real life. So we're going to jump back into the Gemara. Thank you for being willing to jump back and forth. And we'll read a little bit further in the Gemara without going into it in very great depth. and then we'll get to the anecdote. So where we left off was after Tshuva Umasim Tovim, it's the middle of the line, right before the asterisk that says Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. So this next section, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, the next few lines, basically Rabbi Yitzchak lays out this principle, Kol HaMakmit Et Chaveiro, Afilu Bidvarim, Tzarich L'Chaiso, anyone who injures his friend, even with words, right, has to appease him, Shene Amar, and he quotes, sort of, oddly enough, a verse from Mishlei, a passage that really doesn't refer to speech at all, but refers to money, and it's B'ni im e'rat l're'echa t'akata l'zar k'pecha n'keshet b'im re'ficha asezot e'fo b'ni v'hinatel. Basically, if you've lent your friend something, if you've outstretched your hand to someone, it talks about money. You need to keep to that commitment. So that's the end of the pasuk. And basically, the Gemara, so this pasuk talks about if you've committed money, pay your friend back, or if you've taken money, if your friend holds money over you, sort of do good on your obligations. Or on the money that you owe. And the Gemara is using this in the sense of if you owe an apology, if you've taken something from someone, sense of their personality even. The Gemara continues, Im mamon yesh b'yadcha hater lo kisat yad. So if you have money, pay this person back in money. Im lav hirba alav re'im, but if you don't have money, make sure you get him friends, pay him back in some other way. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, A, because I think it's a little tough to get your mind around how the Gemara is using this verse in Mishlei. I have a hard time getting my mind around it. But B, Levinas doesn't go very much into it. And you're logging off. Okay, sorry. But rather just continue in the way that Levinas continues with the Gemara, which is that he basically says, you see, this expresses the value or the importance of appeasing someone when you've offended them with speech. You have to keep to this obligation the way you would keep to a monetary obligation. That's the mashma'ut, that's the sense of it, at least to Levinas. And he sort of leaves it at that. But he goes on to the next section that I bracketed. I'm skipping in the Gemara because Levinas skips in the Gemara. And he goes on to this line that's actually very famous to many of us. Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina. I'm a Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina. Kol nevakesh mitu mechaveiro. Al nevakesh menu yoter mishalosh pa'amim. Anyone who asks appeasement or forgiveness of his friend or her friend should ask no more than three times. Shana Emar, Ana Sana the Ata Sana. As it says, and this is a quote from the Joseph story, when Yosef's brothers are asking forgiveness, basically after Yaakov dies, they're all worried, and it uses three languages of requesting forgiveness, and the Gemara here is deriving this concept of don't ask more than three times, or at least you don't have to ask more than three times. Okay, and now if you jump down to the next bracketed line where you see Rav Havalei Milta, this is where Levinas jumps back in, really in earnest. And this is where we get the anecdote. So, a couple interesting stories. Any questions so far that are like really plaguing people or keeping you from understanding? Feel free to jump right in. Rav Havalei Milta Bahade Hahu Tavsa. Rav had an issue, had a matter, had some sort of fight with this butcher. And by the way, this line doesn't seem to tell us who's right and who's wrong. It doesn't seem to imply who should be asking whom of forgiveness. But what we'll see is that Rav seems to think that the other guy should be asking him for forgiveness. So, lo ata lakame b'male yom ha'kipure. He did not come before him, so again, ambiguity of pronouns here, but he did not come before him is the butcher did not come before Rav to ask forgiveness before Yom Kippur. So Rav says, Amar, ihu izo ana, l'fi yusele. I'm going to go and try and make up with him. The reason I say that Rav is thinking that the butcher needs to ask him for forgiveness is because the previous story is sort of a similar situation where Rabbi Zeira has been wronged and goes to sort of stand in front of this person so as to give him an opportunity to ask forgiveness from him. So this is the same sort of situation. I'm going to go there. I'm going to go to him. I'm going to go to this butcher, and maybe he'll realize I'm there, and he'll realize he has to ask me for forgiveness. Hagabe Rav Huna. So Rav Huna meets Rav on the way, meaning on his way to see the butcher. Amar Lehe Chaka'azo, where are you going? He says to him. Lehe Chaka'azo Mar, I'm sorry. Amar Lehe, he responds, L'fiyuse L'planya, I'm going to so-and-so, you know, so that he can make up with me, or that I can make up with him. Amar, so Rav Huna replies, Azil Abba L'miktal Nafsha. You, Abba, as being an honorable, you are going to kill someone. Huna doesn't think this is a very good idea for Rav to go marching in butchers to demand forgiveness. I'm sorry, to demand him ask for forgiveness. So he keeps going, Azal, the Kamulai, have a Yativ, the Kapali Reisha. He comes upon him, and the guy, the butcher, is sitting and chopping the head of whatever animal he's chopping. So he's doing his butcher thing. Dali Eine, he raises his eyes, the butcher. Dechazye, and the butcher sees him. Amar Le, Abba, At Zil. He says to him, Abba, go, leave. Lately, Miltava Hadach, I've got nothing to say to you. I have no matter with you. The Hade de Kapale Reisha, as he was chopping this head, Ishtame Garma, Umache Bekue Bekatle. Some bone dislodged itself, some bone came out and flew into his throat and killed him. End of story. And where Levinas goes with this, I did not direct this either, just for time's sake, but I'm going to read a piece, just a line or two for you. He sees this as the failure of forgiveness. He sees this as, yeah, ideally, this whole process of appeasing someone should work, but it doesn't. The way he puts it is the game of offense and forgiveness is a dangerous one. And he says, this story doesn't want to tell us of this miraculous moment where just at that moment the bone popped out and killed the guy. Rather, it wants to speak to us of the purity which can kill. There's an idealism that Rav has that doesn't seem to match what's going on. And it ends poorly. It ends tragically. And that's what he says. And I didn't bring this to you in writing only because the next story and last story and the last thing that Levinas talks about, really, it sort of is a similar message. So we're going to look at that story. We'll look at the Levinas inside, and then we'll try and sort of pull some things together before. Okay, so our butcher is dead, but Rav appears in the next story. And I want you to think about why Rav is playing a role in both of these stories back to back. I think there's some. So we're on the very last line of the Gemara here on this page. Rav have a pasuk sidra coming to Rebbe. So Rav is learning or reading some text before Rebbe. Ayu, Ata, when they turn to the next page, Rabbi Sia. So in comes Rabbi Sia. What does Rav do? Adar Lareisha. He goes back to the beginning. In other words, he starts again because Rabbi Sia came in late. You know, if someone comes in late, a student comes in late to your class, you go back to the beginning. By the way, this is what I've covered. But then, Ayil Bar Kapara. So the next guy comes in late. Hadar Lareisha. He goes back again to the beginning. At Rabbi Shimon Berebi. So Rabbi Shimon Berebi comes in. And again, Hadar Lareisha. So each time a new scholar comes into the room, Rav goes back to the beginning. After Rabbi Hanina Bar Chama, so finally Rabbi Hanina Bar Chama comes in. Amar Kule Hai Nehadar. I'm going to go back again all these times. Benizal Lo Hadar. He keeps going. He does not go back to the beginning. Ikpid Rabbi Hanina. Hanina is offended. Azal Rav, so that's the end of the incident. Then, we're told, Azal Rav Lagabe Tlesar Male Yoma Dikipure. Rav goes to Rabbi Hanina asking for forgiveness 13 Arve Yom Kippur, right? 13 Arab Yom Kippurs, 13 years in a row, Velo Isaye. Rabbi Hanina refuses to be appeased, refuses to forgive. So now the Gemara has a commentary on this story. The first question the Gemara asks, V'hechi Avid Hachi, how could he have done this? How could Rav have done this? Done what? V'ha Amar Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, kol mevakesh mitzumech haveiro, al mevakesh meni yoter mishalosh pa'amim. What do we know? You're only supposed to ask 3 times. So how could Rav have gone 13 times in a row? So the answer that the Gemara gives is Rav Shani. Okay, Rav is different. Maybe he... Later, maybe he understood more about forgiveness than we do. Maybe he is the exception to every rule. I don't know, but Rav is different. So then the Gemara asks, Rabbi Hanina, hechi avid hachi, how could Rabbi Hanina have behaved in this matter? How could he not have forgiven Rav 13 times? The Ha'ara Rava, but don't we know that Rava says, kol ma'avir al midotav ma'avirin lo al kol sha'av, that anyone who is sort of mochel on their kavod, like forgiving offenses to himself, to his ego, easy on his ego, right? Anyone who's willing to be mochel on his kavod, we're going to be willing to be mochel on his sins. In other words, it's a statement of the value of being easygoing and forgiving offenses. And so how could Rabbi Hanina have been so stubborn? Rabbi Hanina chalma chazele. Rabbi Hanina had a dream. Or maybe he had a dream after the incident. We're not clear on when this dream happened, but it's an interesting dream. Chazele l'Rav, about Rav. So Rabbi Hanina had a dream about Rav, just zakfuhu v'dikla, that Rav was hanging from a palm tree. Historians will have a field day with that. But... hanging from a palm tree, ugamire, and we learned, in other words, we know, dekol dezakfuhu bedikla reisha have. Anyone who is seen hanging from a palm tree in a vision will become a reisha, become a leader of some sort. In other words, he saw that Rav was going to become a leader. Rabbi Hanina was the leader of the academy, actually, and he sees that Rav has some sort of leadership aspiration. Marsh, Mamina, Ba'e Lamabad Rishuta. He says, Rav has aspirations of being big kahuna, Lo Yisai. And he refused to forgive him. Yechid Elizal Ligmar Oraita Babel. He eventually went and taught in Babel. Meaning he achieved great scholarship in Babel. So this is the story. The story is that Rav offends Rabbi Hanina. Rav asks, begs, please forgive him. Rabbi Hanina refuses to forgive him. Why? He knows that Rav has future in leadership. And listen to what Levinas does with this. I really think it gets at the crux of the challenge of asking forgiveness. So flip to last page. Basically, he says that Rabbi Hanina finds out through a dream more about Rav than Rav knew about himself. The dream revealed Rav's secret ambition beyond the inoffensive gesture at the origin of the incident. Rav, without knowing it, wished to take his master's place. Basically, Rabbi Nas, before this little excerpt, says, I had a really hard time understanding this story. I don't know what it's trying to teach me. But I started asking friends, and I asked this one friend of mine, and she is into psychoanalysis, and she helped me understand that this is about Rav's unconscious. And he says, Rabbi Hanina could not forgive because Rav himself didn't realize the extent of the offense. And if you look at that underlined, the first underlined line here, how is one to forgive if the offender, unaware of his deeper thoughts, cannot ask for forgiveness? Basically, you need full awareness of what you've done. And Rav doesn't even realize that what he's done comes from some unconscious desire to be in a leadership role. And the next underlined line that you see here, the aggressiveness of the offender is perhaps his very unconsciousness. And we all know what this is like, you know. I have memories from when I was 11, 12, 13 years old and someone said something to me and it hurt so much that I carry it with me to this day. And I had this conversation with someone over Shabbat. She said, she's a woman in her 50s and she's 25 years who never knew that there was something that she did that this woman still carried. Someone had no clue. How could you possibly ask for forgiveness if you don't even know what you've done or if you don't even know what it means to the other person? This is where the whole thing gets messy. This is where, you know, this culture that we have of do forgive me, anything that I've done unintentionally, intentionally, do forgive me, like this, you know, this culture of running around and asking for forgiveness sort of glibly like that. That sort of falls apart because we never know the extent of what we've done. And we might be carrying things around with us that the other person has no clue offended us so deeply. So Levinas has sort of put us in a catch-22. He has said forgiveness is of the utmost importance. Yom Kippur isn't going to sweep that under the rug. We need to really reconcile. We need to really think about what we've said and how we've said it and who we might have offended. And saying things is just as important as hurting someone physically and all this stuff. And then when it comes down to the real deal, when it comes down to true life, it's really hard to ever accomplish that. And I think this story, even more than the last story, puts us in that catch-22. And so that's the tragedy, I think, Levinas leaves us with. This Talmudic reading goes on, and he weaves it into theme, and he weaves it, even puts something out there about whether we can forgive the Nazis, or if, you know, maybe the Nazis who didn't intend, had it in their unconscious, you know, maybe a little bit more, but those who were very conscious about it, definitely not. I mean, it's fascinating. But it's sort of sobering going into Yom Kippur, thinking about, you know, that image of the words we say are like feathers, you know, you go and you release the feathers and then you try and go back and gather them up, but they've flown everywhere. I'd love to open it up to thoughts, to comments. I'm really not used to teaching to a screen like this. So please do type in, and we'll have a conversation for at least another. By the way, hi, Saul Guberman in Brooklyn. Saul, you definitely have something to say. Any thoughts? Like, does this, what does this do to the way that you all look at a piece of Gemara? What does this do to the way you look at Yom Kippur? Any comments? If you don't, that's fine. I do want to then read you one more excerpt. There is a comment. John Dine. Great question. Levinas think that we have the obligation, well, this was this woman I was talking to, so we have the obligation to call up that friend who said something 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. We have the obligation to smooth these things over before Yom Kippur. I don't know. I think Levinas might say we have the obligation, but can we ever really fully smooth it over? I think he would say that if we don't at least try, remember that's in his original conception of sins against our fellow man. Those things hang in the balance and upset the universal order. Those things matter. Those things, he says, 100 years from now, have some sort of implications in the divine. Yeah, David says we should talk about them and tell the person. I mean, it's hard because, you know, then does that bring up more resentment? I think we need to do it in a way that is not further offensive, but allows for things to, but I think Levinas would say, you know, he doesn't want a history that comes to terms with our pride. He doesn't want time to just go on and we forget about it. If there's something that's hanging, we need to let it go. And if the only way to do that is call that person up, I mean, I don't know if it's realistic. You know, that's a weird conversation to have. But wouldn't that person be... any other thoughts about that? If not, I'm just going to read this other excerpt. Did I Xerox it for you? Yeah, thanks, Saul. Right, that's true, because we can prevent stuff from going on like that for 10, 20 years. Not confronting in an offensive way, but saying, you know, what used to really hurt me, and I don't want that hanging over us. Stuff, I mean, it's stuff that people say all the time, completely innocently. Hey, I like your shirt, and that was actually the day that you were really self-conscious about what you wore, and when she said that, it sounded sarcastic, and you thought she really hated what your shirt was, and like, it just happens all the time. Right. Right. It's the worst. That's the worst with people that you're closest to because it's loaded. But I believe that, you know, it creates a cycle. Does it make you sound too sensitive? I think you have to deal with the reality of what's going on inside your own subjective mind. And if the reality is there, if the offense is there, right. I mean, it's funny. I have a friend who was one of my best friends growing up, and something that she said to me once, and I remember it in sixth grade. What do you mean by, so is get too close to God? What do you mean by that, David? Will be more painful if you get too close to God. You mean that? I'm not sure what you mean, David. I think, I don't know, I think the task is a, what I love about this is that Levinas just lays it out as what, and then lays it out as a difficulty. So it makes us, I think, do our best. But sometimes people get hurt. I mean, that's, you know, I think what you're saying, David, about it hurts and it's difficult. You know, sometimes you ask someone for forgiveness and it's the butcher who, I mean, whatever you think that story is trying to say, that butcher, you know, causes death, I'm sorry, I just want to read this. What did you say, David? A person. Get a, oh, I think I see what you're saying. Get away with sin against God because there's no other consciousness there. There's no, I don't know God in the way that I know a person. Is that what? Anyway, so I do just want to close now, reminding us what Levinas thinks about Talmud and about the process of Talmudic debate. He says, you know, this is actually when he talks about that weird pasuk from Mishle. And he says, you know, while the sages of the Talmud seem to be doing battle with each other by means of biblical verses, like it seems like they're just, you know, using this pasuk as a weapon against each other, and they seem to be splitting hairs. They are far from such scholastic exercises. He says, all this chocolataria, all this back and forth, and we say, oh, the Gemara says this, the Gemara says that. It's not just about scholastic exercise. The reference to biblical verse does not aim at appealing to authority. So it's not because they want to use a pasuk and say, you see, I'm right, I've got a pasuk that agrees with me. Rather, the aim is to refer to a context which allows the level of the discussion to be raised. Make one notice the true import of the data from which the discussion derives. I think the takeaway in terms of like skills or process, the takeaway in terms of process, we have the takeaway in terms of this before, in terms of process is that every line in the Gemara, every pasuk that's used, is meant for something larger, for some larger idea to come to the fore. Every anecdote, yeah, it's a nice story, but there's a message there. And every distinction the Mishnah throws out about Be'azam Lakom, Be'azam Chaveiro, is something fundamental there. And I think it's rather elegant the way that Levinas it. And I hope you enjoy our time here. And it should be, the rest of this week should be a time when we're able to make those phone calls, smooth over those things that we've been, maybe to make those phone calls to people that we think we might have offended not really knowing the extent of our family. So Shana Tova, and a happy and a easy and meaningful fast this week. Out of here.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.